Good evening and welcome back to Mask's weekly radio show on family matters. Mask, mothers and fathers align saving kids, kids of all ages and all stages for mental health issues, including addictions. If you have a child that's struggling in school, we have a yeshiva liaison that's available to help you place your child in a school where they can succeed. So feel free to give us a call at our confidential, even anonymous, helpline at 718-758-0400. And Mask offers free naloxone training and free kits. So if you know someone that would benefit by having a free naloxone kit, which is another form of Narcan, in their home, in their synagogue, place of worship, wherever it may be, please have them call our helpline and we can go to where they are to train them for free naloxone for opioid overdose. It's a prevention kit. It is very easily administered. It's through the nose where you can just save a life in a matter of moments. So it's so important that we have them everywhere available, in homes, in schools, in religious places, wherever you worship. Please call Mask for that free training and free kit. Tonight I'm very, very honored to have with us a world-famous psychologist and leader in his field, Dr. Javier Amador, who's internationally renowned. He is working, leading individual family, child, and couples therapist. He's always been on all the different stations, ABC, NBC, PBS, everywhere, CBS, CNN, and his specialty, he is the founder of the LEAP Institute. Welcome, Dr. Amador. Thank you for being on tonight. How are you?
Good evening. I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm just really grateful for the life-saving work that you all are doing.
Thank you. Thank you. We are doing this work. We're coming up to our 23rd year. We're starting now in February, and 100,000 families who've met with me, who've spoken to me, who we've tried to help and direct them to the right professional therapy, inpatient, outpatient clinics of all different sorts, schools, issues at home. And one topic that always comes up, whether it's mental health, even addiction, is the same about, typically about denial. And I'd like you first to talk about what is LEAP Institute so that my listeners will understand where you're coming from.
Well, LEAP Institute actually has morphed and only less than 3 years ago into the LEAP Foundation. So like you, we're also a nonprofit, and our goal is to educate people about the nature of you know, what we typically think of as denial when somebody with addiction or a serious mental illness says, I'm not sick, leave me alone, you're the crazy one, not me, I don't have a problem. When someone says that over and over and over again in the face of such obvious evidence that something's wrong, what is that problem? What is the nature of that problem, and how can we best help that person? So that's what the LEAP Foundation and previously the LEAP Institute is all about. It's about providing free training and resources and education so that families know how to help their loved ones.
Right. And what does LEAP stand for?
It stands for Listen, Empathize, Agree, and Partner. Very unique kind of listening and empathy, and the agreements are very strategic. And the partnering is really partnering with the person to make better decisions for their life, whether it's getting into addiction treatment, whether it's getting into psychiatric treatment for bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, etc.
So families that are struggling, like you said, schizophrenia, all mental health issues, more often than not, we know that their loved ones are in denial. They may, you know, say there's nothing wrong with me. How common is it? So I would like my listeners to understand that it's not mm-hmm. just their child. I want you to please go into how common is it that someone with mental illness is in denial?
Well, in the case of mental illness, we're talking 50%, half of all people with these serious mental illnesses, and I'm for the purposes of our conversation, focusing on schizophrenia, schizoaffective, bipolar disorder, 50%. That's about 5 million to 6 million Americans don't understand they have a mental illness. What's really surprising is to a lot of people is that the research is abundantly clear that the problem actually isn't denial. That in those 50% of people who have mental illness and don't believe they have mental illness, the problem is typically a neurocognitive deficit. In other words, just another symptom of the illness. It has a tongue twister of a name. I didn't give it the name. The name was given 101 years ago by the Hungarian neurologist Babinski. People have heard of the Babinski reflex in infants. Same neurologist described people with, for example, paralysis, who are completely unaware that they had paralysis, and he coined the term anosognosia. So, where am I going with this? 50% of people with these serious mental illnesses have, in fact, anosognosia. It's not denial, it's anosognosia. It's a cognitive deficit typically mediated by the frontal lobes of the brain. And the impact for me as a clinician, as someone who is an advocate and trying to help, but also as a family member, because I had a brother with schizophrenia who had anosognosia, didn't understand he was ill. The impact of understanding that this is not a choice, this is not my loved one being stubborn, or that my brother wasn't being immature or, quote, in denial, but instead was suffering from a symptom of his illness, just like the delusions, just like the hallucinations. He had a cognitive deficit that left him unable to see he was ill. The impact on me was profound. It completely changed my attitude from one of frustration, even anger, of trying to, from his perspective, beat him over the head with education about his mental illness, to an attitude of patience, of realizing I had to build a relationship with him where he could trust me, where he could feel that I wasn't judging him.
Your brother was 21 years old when he developed those symptoms and the struggle of denial with mental illness. How old were you at the time?
Well, he was 21 when he started showing some of the early signs. It wasn't until he was 29 that he had full-blown hallucinations and delusions. I was 8 years younger, 21. I was 21 years old, and I got a call from my brother when I was 21 years old saying that he had killed our father, and then he hung up. I wasn't laughing at the time. I was in shock. I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't believe it. And it turns out he had a delusion that he had killed actually our stepfather. And what had happened is our stepfather had sadly had a heart attack at a young age. And my brother, Henry, believed in the midst of this tragedy that he had somehow caused it. The particulars of his delusion don't, I think, really matter for our conversation.
No.
But suffice to say, it was bizarre. It didn't make any sense. And I immediately started to try to talk him out of it. And I also, as soon as I was in the door and at my parents' house and with my brother who had been living with them, immediately started to try to convince my brother to go see a psychiatrist. And this is with the support of seven brothers and sisters who all elected me, sort of the family psychologist at the time. I wasn't a psychologist. I was a senior in college. But I took on the role because my brother and I had been very close. Even though he was 8 years older, he was, by far the sibling I was closest to in my family for many reasons. And so I tried to convince him to get help. And, my words of encouragement, my doses of reality that I tried to give him, Henry, don't you see that there's nobody here? The voices you hear aren't real. You couldn't possibly have killed Dad in the way that you said you did. We all know it was a heart attack. All those words fell on deaf ears. And not because my brother was in denial. That's what I thought at the time. But because my brother had another symptom of schizophrenia called anosognosia. He was incapable of seeing what was so obvious to the whole family, that he really desperately needed help.
In general, psychiatrists, do they label it anosognosia when families come in? Do they tell them this is what's going on?
Great question. I'm so glad you asked it. This is why we founded the LEAP Foundation. It's actually called the LEAP Foundation for Research to Practice. In other words, what we're trying to do is close the gap because there's between the research, what we actually know to be true, and the practice. What do psychiatrists actually do? What do nurses do? What do psychologists do? And if you want more information about what we do and also a lot of free information, you can go to LFRP.org. It stands for LEAP Foundation for Research to Practice, LFRP.org. And the short answer is no. A lot of psychiatrists still don't understand this is anosognosia, you don't have to take my word for it, but it's anosognosia that we're dealing with in half of all people with these serious mental illnesses. All you have to do is open up the diagnostic manual that every psychiatrist uses. The last one that was published 7 years ago now, has a description of anosognosia in there and what it predicts. It predicts that the person will not take medicine, will refuse medicine. It predicts involuntary hospitalizations. It predicts a poor course of illness if the person has this symptom of what people normally call denial.
I would like to ask you, Doctor, there are families that are struggling, so many. Every day we get calls, every single day, another family that's, been admitted, their child doesn't want to take the medication, they're being held against their will, they have to go in front of a judge. They could be there for 4, 6, 8 weeks in a hospital before they even finally agree. Let's talk about what the problems that's caused as a result of anosognosia, please.
Well, we get the same calls and emails every day. And it's tragic what happens because it's all well-meaning, the efforts to educate the person, convince the person they're mentally ill, and then we force treatment on them. I believe that court-ordered treatment is a very useful tool, but it's not a solution. It doesn't get us where we want to be, which is with the person, engaged, accepting treatment, for a lifetime, taking medicine for a lifetime. What gets us there, it turns out, is building a different kind of relationship with the person. And that's what LEAP stands for. It's listening reflectively. So when someone says to me, Dr. Amador, hey, I'm not sick and I don't need these medicines. These medicines are poison. I reflect that back. So what you're telling me is you're not sick and these medicines not only don't help you, but they're poisonous to you. Is that right? Did I understand you correctly? That's LEAP reflective listening. We teach parents to do this, brothers, sisters, doctors to do this. We teach law enforcement to do this and judges. Because what it does is it immediately lowers the person's defensiveness. They're being treated with respect and a lack of judgment when we reflect back what they're saying to us. And then we ask, you know, with genuine humility, did I understand you correctly? You know, did I get it right? We're showing real curiosity. And, you know, to quote a poet from 2,000 years ago, we're interested in others when they are interested in us. And that's sort of the foundation of using reflective listening. Then we also use empathy, but not just any kind of empathy. It's very strategic. It's focused on those feelings. That's the E in LEAP. On those feelings the person has that put a wedge between them and the people that are trying to help them. So I might say, it must be so frustrating for you to be in the hospital. You must be so angry at me for testifying at the mental health hearing that got you this court order. I'd be angry too. Anybody would be angry. It's going out of our way to acknowledge and respect the feelings the person has that they're often left all alone with. And that includes feelings that they have that are related to their delusion. So this is, again, what we teach at the LEAP Foundation. And what we look for are areas where we can agree. That's the A in LEAP. We're not going to agree on you have a mental illness. Because the nature of anosognosia, it turns out, this thing that looks like denial, the nature of this unawareness of the illness is that it doesn't improve with treatment. So a person may accept treatment, may be forced into treatment, but don't expect that their awareness, their insight, is going to get better. And that means what we really need to create are strong relationships where the person agrees to stay in treatment because of us, because we care about them, because we'd like them to stay in treatment. It's a non-specific reason, but it's a reason that, frankly, we do many things. We sacrifice so many things for the same reason. And what we're talking about is someone feeling loved, someone feeling respected, someone feeling listened to. You know, we go to great lengths to care for the people that we have those feelings for and that we love. And the same is true of someone with mental illness. They're still a person. And if they feel that we're listening and that we care and that we're not fighting with them and pointing a finger at them and telling them they're mentally ill, they're much more likely to be interested in doing the things that we ask them to do for us. Like, say, in treatment.
You're talking about...
And that's what we...
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you're talking about schizophrenia, for instance. Can you explain the first signs of schizophrenia? And at what age can, or more often, do the symptoms generally start?
Well, I'll answer your last question first. In men and women, it's a little bit different. In men, it's late teens to early 20s, and in women, typically it's in the mid-20s. Early to mid-20s. The presentation of symptoms will vary from person to person. So you may have somebody like my brother Henry, who his presentation were a lot of social withdrawal, a lot of what we call negative symptoms. So he lost the ability to express a lot of emotion. He didn't speak very much. Alogia is the technical term. He stopped working. He wasn't able to work. His relationships fell away one by one, you know, like leaves coming off a tree in the fall. Just one by one, his friendships flooded away. And he moved back home to live with my parents. This is in his early 20s. That's one way that you see the onset, negative symptoms first, and then the person has the first full-blown psychotic episode and get diagnosed. Other times, people... The onset starts with a full-blown psychotic episode. Now, you know, what do I mean by that? I'm describing, for example, somebody hearing voices of people that are not there. That's the most common type of auditory hallucination, but there's others, hearing other kinds of noises, seeing things that aren't there, so having hallucinations, and or you can have this together or present with delusions. So paranoid delusions that I'm being followed, grandiose delusions that I'm, you know, a member of a world leadership and I need to meet with the, you know, the world leaders in Davos. So that would be a grandiose delusion, paranoid delusion, delusions of jealousy, believing that somebody that you love is cheating on you when they're not. There's all kinds of delusions that one can have. But typically we see delusions and hallucinations together on the when there's the onset of the illness.
And what triggers the schizophrenia?
Well, if I knew that exactly, I'd have the Nobel Prize. it's multifactorial. And what does multifactorial mean? There's lots of different things that trigger the onset of the illness. There's really two pathways to developing schizophrenia. You can either have genetic risk for the illness, or you could have had injury to your developing brain. And there's lots of different things that can happen. Everything from head injuries as a young child to intrauterine insults to the developing fetal brain during the second trimester. So the point is that you're born, whether it be by genes or environment, with a vulnerability for the illness. And, you know, we know there's gender differences between men and women. We think it all boils down to stress and stress typically triggers the onset of the illness.
The same with bipolar?
Yes.
Right.
Very, very, very similar.
Very similar. So how does one know if it's bipolar or schizophrenia? Like, what are those similar differences?
Well, with bipolar, you can see some of the psychotic symptoms I was describing, the delusions, the false beliefs, or the
right.
hallucinations. But you also see mood episodes, so very severe episodes of depression, not just normal everyday depression. You know, being depressed for 2 weeks or longer, thoughts of death or suicide, not sleeping or sleeping too much. Or you see manic episodes. And with bipolar, what we see is a fluctuation between the depressive episodes to the manic episodes. And in a manic episode, we see things like somebody who has incredibly poor judgment, who's racing around at high speed, not sleeping, talking a mile a minute. The technical term for that is pressured speech, exhibiting grandiose ideas or grandiose delusions even. So these are two really different mood syndromes, the manic syndrome versus the depressive syndrome. But we see them in the same person. Typically, they're cycling back and forth between those two mood syndromes. Sometimes you see both mood syndromes at the same time, a mixed state. That's more rare.
So I do want my listeners to know that Dr. Javier Amador is an author of a book, I Am Not Sick, I Don't Need Help. It is available online. You can purchase it. And, doctor, let's get to it. What do my parents that are listening, how do they begin the conversation when someone says, I'm not sick?
First step is to take the goal of convincing your son or daughter that they're sick. Take that goal and put it high up, put it in a box, and put that box high up on a shelf in a back closet. Don't try and convince the person they're ill. If you've tried and you're met with anger and you're met with what appears to be stubbornness and your child withdraws from you, stop. Stop and change course. Instead of telling the person that they're ill and what they need, apologize for having done that in the past. That's step two, is to say, hey, I'm sorry that I you know, dad and I or mom and I were telling you that you were sick and needed help. We're not going to do that anymore. We just want to be helpful to you. And listen
well, then get me out of the hospital. And then
exactly. So, and then you reflect back using leap reflective listening. So what you would like is for me to get you out of the hospital. Is that correct? Yes. And where that may lead, that kind of reflective listening and empathy, where you empathize and say, I can see why you're angry and why you want to get out of the hospital and why you're angry at us for calling the crisis team. We'd be angry too. And it sounds like you're contradicting yourself, but you're really not, because what you ultimately say is, well, let's see what we can agree on. We don't want you in the hospital. We want you living your life. And what they're telling you here is that the only way they're going to release you and the thing that they're recommending is that you stay on this medicine. Why don't we partner for at least, just for a month anyway? And you bite off, you know, what you can chew. For a month, let's agree that you'll stay on this medicine. What do you think? And we'll work really hard to get you out of the hospital. Or accept a long-acting, or accept a long-acting injectable medication.
Right, I was just going to say that. What happens sometimes, they really don't want to take the meds, or they may be irresponsible, and then the hospital offers the long-acting the injection.
Yep.
So can you talk about that a moment, please?
Well, it's a wonderful option, and there's many different drugs that come in a long-acting injectable form. What's so good about it is that it's a built-in smoke detector. It tells you, you know, if a person has missed a dose of a long-acting injectable antipsychotic medication because they've missed an appointment. They didn't get the injection. When somebody has a bottle of pills, you don't know when they've stopped taking the pills until they become ill again. So that's one big benefit. The other benefit is it reduces anxiety in the relationship you have with your loved one. So if you're a parent worried about your child, you know, if they have a bottle of pills, you're walking on eggshells. You're walking around anxious and sometimes arch your eyebrows when you ask the question, did you take your meds? Because you're not so sure the person has taken their meds because you know they don't believe they're ill. Well, with long-acting injectable medication, there's no arched eyebrows, there's no question, because you know whether you're child has taken their medicine or not, because they've either made the appointment and gotten the injection or they haven't. There's other benefits that we don't really have time to talk about, but among them, just one I'll highlight is that if somebody misses a dose, it's not like they're going to relapse tomorrow. You have time because there's a steady state blood level with most of these long-acting injectables, that you have time to use your relationship to listen, to empathize, to look for agreement and partner on that with your son or daughter so that they will go back and get the next injection. You're having an argument, hopefully it's not an argument, you're having a discussion once a month, or in some of the formulations, once every 3 months, instead of every day when somebody is on pills.
Using the LEAP approach, what do you do when someone asks you, do you think I'm mentally ill?
So you like to know if I think you're mentally ill. You reflect that question back. You try to delay giving your opinion on that because that's an opinion that's only going to cause conflict. So one of the 7 LEAP tools, we have 7 communication tools that we teach, that's not in the acronym, is delay giving your opinion.
Right. And
getting a job.
I'm sorry, we're running out of time, but I do know that they can go onto your website to learn more about the LEAP approach.
Yes, and there's free videos as well that actually
right.
train you in the 7 LEAP tools.
Right. Well, I'm sorry I have to cut you short. This is so interesting and could be so helpful to everyone that is struggling with a loved one, that they can go on, listen to your YouTube videos. There's so much out there. Thank you, Dr. Amador, so much for being
welcome.
On with us tonight. And
my pleasure.
I hope to have you on again soon. I'd like to wish everyone a very good evening, a wonderful Shabbos. Always remember, hang in, hold on, and hug tight. We'll have more of these kinds of shows coming up. Thank you again, and have a good night.